was relapsums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 146 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. In Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from San Francisco, California, is Andrew Brokus. How are you, Andrew?
Oh, I'm doing very well. How are you?
Fantastic. Not least because I just started BoJack Horseman.
Yeah, really, really a brilliant show, I think.
Yeah, I'm a fan. And how does it feel to be back home?
It's nice. I mean, as much as I enjoyed, I miss being able to play online poker. I kind of forget how much I miss being able to play online poker until I'm actually playing online poker. Like, it is so nice to just be able to, like, start up your computer and be playing poker. Yeah. But, yeah, other than that, it's good to be back. I'm sort of a homebody at heart. So as much as I enjoy, being able to play online, and then I got to visit some of my best friends and my family and whatnot while I was on the East Coast. But ultimately, I'm kind of most happy when I'm not running around.
Fantastic. I was glad that your mom did in fact make her podcast debut last week, very briefly.
Yes, a bit of an Easter egg on there for those of you who listen all the way past the end, the end music.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's going to be a good show today, and why don't you tell us why?
So our guest today is a former poker professional, Asani Fisher. Some of the old school people on 2+2 may recognize that name. And Asani now makes his living playing daily fantasy sports. So we certainly will talk some about his poker career. This is not one of those shows where we don't mention poker at all. But I would say this interview is at least as much about the daily fantasy sports scene as it is about poker. And we'll talk about DFS generally, and we'll also discuss some of the recent news surrounding DFS, like the so-called insider trading scandal, although you'll hear Asani talk about why he doesn't think that's really an apropos name. Essentially the ban on daily fantasy sports from Nevada, or at least the requirement that they be licensed, which at the moment none of them are. So we've got that coming up. And the other thing that's coming up is Christmas and Hanukkah and that entire orgy of consumerism that is the so-called holiday season. We here at the Knitcast, certainly not encouraging you to go crazy with your gift giving. We do not want to see you spend a bunch of money on some crap that the recipients may not even want. But if you're going to do it anyway, go ahead and use our Amazon affiliate link while you're at it. You can go to www.thinkingpoker.net, click on Support the Podcast, and there you will find links for Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, .fr, .es, .it. We might even have the Australia one on there, I don't remember. Anyway, click on the one where you'll be doing your shopping, then go ahead and shop as usual. It won't cost you anything extra, but Nate and I will get a little piece of your sale, and that will make our holiday season a little brighter. The end of the year is also a good time to think about charitable donations. It's your last chance to lock in a tax deduction for 2015. And more broadly, it's just a time to be charitable and to think about others. The Amazon affiliate link, like we said, that's not going to cost you anything. If you do want to spend a little money to show your appreciation for the podcast, we certainly would appreciate that as well. Speaking only for myself here, the best thing you could do for me is to make a donation to an organization called the Bay Area Urban Debate League. This is an organization I've been closely involved with since I moved to San Francisco. It's quite similar to other organizations I've worked with in Chicago and in Boston. And recently, I joined the board of directors. So I know firsthand that this is an organization that spends its money wisely and that does great things for the kids it serves. And these are mostly public high school kids from high poverty neighborhoods, many of them from families with an annual income below the poverty line. And the Bay Area Urban Debate League supports a lot of different debate opportunities for them, both in the classroom, competitive after-school teams, traveling to compete elsewhere. Debate is a program that I got a lot out of in my life, and I've seen it do a lot well, for a lot of people, but I think in particular, it's a good opportunity for kids who go to schools and come from neighborhoods where they don't often have a lot of opportunities for like really intellectual kinds of outlets. It's particularly good, I think, for those sorts of kids. Now, there are some people on the board who raise some really serious money for this organization, like truly wealthy people who are raising your tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And they know when they added me to the board that I was not in a position to raise that kind of money. I'm there mostly because of my experience and expertise. But I would prefer not to be completely embarrassed this fundraising season, and for that, I could use your help. I would be very grateful for any donation that you make to the Bay Area Urban Debate League. We've actually already had one listener who chose to donate $1 for every episode of the podcast, which I thought was an awesome idea and extremely generous. But even if you want to give just a couple of big blinds for whatever game it is that you play, that would be great and much appreciated. You can donate by going to www.baudl.org. and clicking donate. There you'll find an address. If you want to pay by check, you can do it by PayPal, you can do it by credit card. Whatever you choose to do, please include a note saying that you're donating in my name. You'll still be the one to get the tax deduction, but this way the folks at the BAUDL will see that I'm doing my part to help out in terms of raising money. My name, by the way, is Andrew Brokos, B-R-O-K-O-S, for those of you who don't know, and you can make that donation at baudl.org. Thanks very much. And while we're on the subject of holiday giving, Nate, what do you think about giving some kind of gift to either the floor people or the dealers at your usual card game? Is that something that you think is expected? Is it something you usually do? Is it something you recommend? Do you need to turn your microphone back on?
Yes, I do need to turn my microphone back on. Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about that, but can I interject a small something on the previous subject?
Absolutely
first?
Not.
Which is that, what? Sorry, what? Hey. Okay, fine.
Go ahead.
Which is that, yeah, for those people who, yeah, so it is the holiday season, and I am going to be selling you things. We sell you things. The Urban Debate League is a very worthy target of donation if you're into that sort of thing. As with people who don't write into the show, there are a lot of people who listen to the show and who give brain cycles to the show, and for whatever reason are not going to send us or anybody we advocate for money. And I always just want to say thanks to those people too. And so. Thanks if you're just doing that. Even though we're gonna give you a lot of suggestions for places to put your money, a shout out to everybody who's listening.
Word.
So, money and Christmas and holiday giving. Andrew's question was what I think about tipping people at Christmas. So. As with all customs in poker, there's some regional variation here. I am an advocate for a few reasons of spreading some money around the card room. More often, I just intermittently tip floor people. But if you're not the sort who intermittently tips floor people, the holiday season is a great time to do some tipping for a couple of reasons. Number one is that some of these are just tipped positions, and it's not quite like a waiter or waitress where that's just part of the social contract to do it, and you ought to. But it often is a small Christmas bonus or periodic bonus that's in some sense implicitly part of what they're making, and it's good to participate that if that's the way it is where you play poker. Second is that. I have often found that my wait time for seats magically decreases, and just the overall helpfulness of the floor staff is better when I'm considered a good and productive citizen of the card room. And one way to be considered a good and productive citizen of the card room is not to be perceived as a stiff. And a good way not to be perceived as a stiff is to give the people who might judge you a little bit of money. And so for a lot of reasons, I think in a lot of places, it's in your best interest. In my case, if I'm a regular, I try to toss a floor person a $5 or a $10 chip about once a week, something like that. If that's not how it goes, then Christmas is a good time to maybe give them a green chip or something like that. Depends a little bit on the stakes you play. There are some places where floor people cannot accept tips, but they can receive envelopes, and they don't have to open envelopes on site. So you should feel free to give them a Christmas card. And what you put in the card is your business, and nobody has to know except them. So, yeah, I think tipping dealers is, I mean, that's a different subject, and I think most people understand that that's part of the game. I think tipping floor people, it's a little more complicated because, you know, you shouldn't do it every pot you win or even every session you play. But sending some money their way, that's been both in terms of time I've been at the tables, like getting seated, and in terms of the overall quality of my experience in the card room, it's been a good investment for me.
No, I don't really disagree with anything that you said, and this is something I'm likely to participate in myself this year. But let's say that you knew for certain that you were going to get some kind of preferential treatment as a result of giving the tip. Like you mentioned, having a shorter wait time for seats. Do you think that's ethical to kind of take advantage of that? Even if there's not an explicit, like you're saying to them, hey, I'm going to help you out right now, and maybe in the future, you know, I don't wait as long for a seat. If you believe that that's something they're going to do, I mean, it seems kind of unfair given that the tipping is like not required, and obviously people like a tourist isn't necessarily just going to tip the staff. I mean, is it fair for you to kind of get boosted as a result of doing that?
There's a line beyond which I think it is wrong, and I think that tourists and casual players who don't know to tip or who don't want to tip are sort of getting screwed, and so I think that would be bad. I think I can't say it offends my sensibilities too much if I know that somebody's going to look a little bit harder for me or give me a couple extra seconds to get back from the bathroom before they roll me over or something like that.
That's a little. I thought you were implying like. Getting jumped in the line or something.
Oh, that happens too. Don't get me wrong.
I know it does. That's why I'm saying.
No, I don't think.
I think there's a big difference between like whether they're a little bit lenient in terms of how long they wait to call the next person if you don't respond immediately, and like whether they just skip someone and call you next.
Yeah, I mean, I'd rather there not be the system in place of phantom names on lists and you becoming one of those phantom names if you're in the good graces of the floor people. I think that's not great. And if that were the only benefit to tipping, then I would probably not do it. But things like facilitating, like being able to walk up to a floor person and say, oh, I'm going to play 1-2 PLO. If there's a 2-5 game, please just lock up the seat for me. If there's a 5-10 game, can you put me on the list? But I want to look at it before I take the seat. If a mixed game opens up, I'm willing to start it. And, you know, if you're a team player, and that's not just tipping, that's also like helping the games run and not being an asshole. Like if you're a good card room citizen, somebody will take the time to learn who you are and just satisfy that request without you having to ask twice, and that's amazing. That's a lot better than like, okay, I'd like to get on four lists, my initials are NWM, then like every time, you know, having to like scoot around. It's if you're on the same team in those situations, then it gets a lot better for you.
Yeah, and this is worth mentioning because, in fact, there are quite possibly some floor people from Lucky Chances where I play regularly who are listening right now, which, first off, thank you for listening. And know that if you get anything from me this holiday season, there is certainly, or I want to make very clear, no expectation of any kind of like quid pro quo. In fact, I don't want any sort of quid pro quo that you might be tempted to offer as a result of that, although I think you all seem like ethical people who wouldn't do that. But I'll just make that 100% clear now. If you do get an envelope from me this holiday season, that is solely an appreciation for things that you have already done to keep the room running well and the good customer service that you've provided. Even before I was a tipping regular, I never got any sense of like discrimination there. I felt like I was being treated equally, which I appreciate. So any tip that you get from me is an appreciation for past competence and kindness, and not an expectation of any sort of future compensation.
Yeah. It is nice to have a home card room. It's you feel like you're settled in there now. People know who you are.
Yeah, I guess I'm a regular. I go there like once or twice a week. I definitely don't play as often as the most regular people. But yeah, like I mean, I actually probably know floor people there better than I knew most of the floor people at Pittsburgh, even though I went there more recently. And that's just primarily because some of the floor people at Lucky Chances actually already knew who I was before I got there as a result of this podcast, which certainly is very flattering. But yeah, it doesn't have quite the same. So like the Rivers Casino in Pittsburgh was the first place that I really considered like a home casino. And that really, I mean, they don't get a lot of like, Pittsburgh is not a big tourist city, you know. they don't get a ton of non-regulars playing in the bigger game there, just in the room in general. Like it's a pretty tight community of people there, and it's sort of the same people you see most of the time there. So that, you know, there's really that feeling of like this is just kind of a social club among buddies, and even more so in the higher stakes game there. So I mean, Lucky Chances doesn't quite have that feel to it. Not that Lucky Chances is a big tourist destination, and you know, Colma certainly is not a place that gets a ton of tourist traffic either. But I think there's a somewhat larger crew of people who play there, so there's not quite the same kind of tight knit feel to it. But yeah, it definitely is nice to be in a place where you feel comfortable and you know people and you're known and you have a reputation as a good card room citizen. Those things are all pretty nice.
Yeah.
I was going to ask. I mean, you don't have that kind of relationship at Foxwoods. You don't go there frequently enough, do you?
No, but intermittently, I've been around that card room since 2004. So a lot of people consider me a familiar face. I'm not a regular. I don't show up that much, and I think most of the floor people there wouldn't know my name. But I think I'm sort of in. Yeah, I show up as familiar. I think if a lot of people passed from that card room, I think if they passed me on the street, they would. They would view me as a familiar face. Yeah. Oh, maybe not. I mean, but yeah, no, not a regular anywhere. Not a regular anywhere. It's not easy to get from Boston to Foxwoods. You'd think it would be, but I don't own a car, and the traffic is pretty heinous. So, no, not a regular.
Today's strategy segment is brought to you by Tournament Poker Edge. Tournament Poker Edge is a fantastic resource for any tournament player, whether you're grinding small stakes sit-and-goes online or chasing WSOP circuit rings or anywhere in between. The instructors at Tournament Poker Edge play all sorts of stakes and games, so no matter where you are or what you need, you'll find material to help you improve. You can sign up, you should sign up today at www.tournamentpokeredge.com. Our strategy question is coming to us from Adam. Adam said he recently played a hand that left me thinking about whether I played it correctly, as I'm not used to seeing a recreational player fold an overpair. I'm in immediate position against a recreational player at a 1-2 game, $300 effective stacks, and the recreational player opens with a raise to $12. I call with 8-8. Villain was easy to read, and in this spot I was pretty sure he had 10s through aces. So I called, and the flop came down 5-6-8 rainbow. Villain leads out for $30, and I just call, hoping the board pairs. I'm actually thinking we might just read through this whole thing and then discuss it afterwards rather than going point by point, because I think a lot of the... It all kind of ties together, in my opinion.
Sounds good.
The turn is a 4, putting a second diamond on the board, so the board now is 8-6-5-4 with 2 diamonds. And Adam says, now it's pretty clear that neither of us are playing 7-9 or 7-3 in this spot, so I have the effective nuts. I'll just add, if he's got the board right, any 7 would actually make a straight, but I still think it's not terribly likely that either player has a 7 in his hand, so I do agree with the general point. Villain bets $30 again. I Hollywood for about 15 seconds and then shove for 220 more. He tanked for about 3 minutes and folded, showing pocket queens. Now here's the dilemma. I almost need the board to pair on the river, which will only happen about 20% of the time, for the river to be good for me. Any card 10 through ace, and he could have hit a two-outer. A 7, we both play the board. 9 is a decent card, as is a 2 or a 3, but the majority of river cards are not going to be good for me. 6 of them make it a tie or a loss. So not knowing what he has, obviously if I knew he had queens, I can just call and then bet any river besides a queen, but putting him on a solid range, I can use hacky math and figure I'm 96% to win or tie, with an 8% chance of the tie. That's great, and I'd like to get it all in, but so many rivers are bad for me, I want to get it all in on the turn. Later, after thinking about it, I think I like a 4x raise to $120. That seems like a better move, but I'm not sure the result would have been any different. Did I give up value here, or correctly protect my hand?
It's a good question. I got some thoughts. Do you want to go first, or should I go first?
I've been talking plenty. You go first.
All right. So thought number one is, if you're so sure that he has 10s through aces, then you don't really need to worry about so many rivers. Like a 10 or an ace might give him a set, but it more likely will not give him a set. And also, if he's so easy to read that you know before the flop he has 10s through aces, you're going to have a better sense than you game theoretically ought to as to whether he hit that set on the river. So that's the first thing I want to say, is that being so scared of the river, in terms of whether it's going to give you, whether it's going to promote the opponent ahead of you, is not quite in place. The other reason to be worried about the river, which is part of what Adam was talking about here, is that it might make the board too scary for the opponent, and that's certainly a legitimate fear. But I think the hole in the reasoning here is that the board is already scary for the opponent. And in general, I think if I had to criticize Adam's reasoning at one point, a lot of what he says is right. But what I think is not right is to it sounds like he's overlooking a little bit the fact that the board is already scary for his opponent, and he doesn't seem to have really considered the question how opponent is going to react to this raise, because I mean he's sitting there with an overpair, a lot of two pairs beat him, a lot of sets beat him, 7-7 is a very clear hand that Adam could have that would have just called on the flop that got there on the turn. I think it's going to be hard to call this raise. Certainly if I had a hand like let's say I had 9-8 suited and I called before the flop, trying to use my position in the deep effective stacks against the opponent. Let's say the flop comes 8 high, he bets, I decide I have odds and call, let's say, hypothetically. I'm not sure a flop call would be best there, but put that aside. On the turn, when this scary card comes, if I think the opponent has an overpair, I am definitely raising because I definitely think I can get him to fold, at least sometimes. So if it's that good a bluffing spot with one pair or with whatever other hand you might have, then I think when you have nearly a lock hand, you should not be raising. Certainly not raising to protect your hand in this spot. Okay, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm reminded of a hand that we discussed on here a few weeks ago. It might have been more than a few weeks ago, where it was a player who tried to bluff someone off from an overpair by representing a set, and what you and I both agreed was a pretty good spot, and the guy ended up calling him down. And a lot of people were like, LOL, don't even bother trying to bluff somebody off an overpair, etc., at these small stakes games. So there's kind of two different ways that you can approach this, and it seems like Adam is approaching this from a very kind of exploitive standpoint of just saying, well, you know, these recreational players at 1-2, or maybe just 1-2 players in general, they just kind of never fold over pairs, and so I can just play in kind of like an extremely exploitive way where I kind of imagine Adam is never shoving a hand worse than queens on the turn, and villain really has no incentive whatsoever to call with queens, so you're really just sort of hoping that he makes a massive mistake by calling with queens. And I do think for him to call with queens on the turn would in fact be a massive mistake. Like, not only is he behind any seven, but he's behind potentially kings or aces if you slow played those. He's behind any number of sets that you could have, maybe even two pair. There's like a ton of stuff that beats queens, and there's really no reason why villain should call a shove with queens. Like, this there's there's no way for you to bounce with the shove. They really don't see you showing up with a bluff when you just jam here. So you really just have to be hoping that your opponent is going to make some tremendously bad call with queens. And I realize that some of them will, and some of you are saying, well, yeah, it's 1-2, you know, maybe they will make a terrible call with queens. Okay, maybe they will. I mean, if you really think they will, then you can consider doing this. I will say that you're probably better off raising the flop. Like, if you're sure that your opponent has an overpair and you're sure your opponent is never folding it, then just raise the flop. Like, the board is only going to get scarier for whatever his hand is. And when he has pocket queens and the board is 8-6-5, a 7 is going to be scary for him, a 4, a 9, a king and an ace might also be kind of scary for him. So there's actually a fair number of turn cards, even though your hand feels extremely safe. Like, you know, I'm a huge favorite against the overpair that he almost certainly has. Your hand is safe in the sense that you're not likely to get drawn out on. It's not so safe in the sense that, well, I guess what's not safe is you getting the rest of his stack. Like, I think you're more likely to get his stack, especially if you're confident he has an overpair and pretty sure he won't fold it. I think you're much better off trying to take his stack on the flop, or at least build the pot on the flop, rather than waiting until the board gets scary, as it very often will. I also think, you know, as Nate pointed out, it's not so trivial that someone is never going to fold an overpair in this exact spot, even if this player is like a little more reluctant to fold over pairs than he should be, which I imagine is the case given that he tanked 3 minutes on what should have been a trivial fold. It still doesn't mean you're guaranteed to get paid off, you know, no matter what the situation. And I do think, yeah, as we've discussed, this is a spot where it's particularly difficult to get paid by queens. If you're taking the kind of non-exploitive approach where you're not just going to say, well, I hope my opponent just plays, you know, blatantly terribly and I can make a really unbalanced, you know, do a line that I would only ever take with a value hand or something, I think there is a case for just flat calling the flop because, you know, top set in general is a pretty good slow playing hand. Your hand is relatively safe. If you think there's a chance of villain having hands other than overpairs, there's more of a case for just flat calling the flop, because then if he has ace king, you give him room to bluff again on the turn, you give him room to improve to an ace or a king. So I don't necessarily hate the flat call on the flop, I just don't like it against an opponent who you think is going to be way too loose with an overpair and who you're pretty confident has an overpair. But if you do that, you just have to accept that this is a bad turn card, this is a below average turn card for you, and you may not be able to take a stack here. No one promised you're going to win a stack every time that you have a set versus an overpair, and this just might be a spot where you have to call. I think everything Nate said is true about the river really can't be that bad for you. The hands your opponent is most likely to have all only have two outs. So, yeah, you don't know which one it is, but it's not like you're going to be folding if the river is a king and your opponent bets, unless you really feel that confident in your ability to read him. But you know, you're like, it's not like he's going to accidentally bluff you out by betting queens when the river is a king. Like, if you think he's going to bet queens on the river, then you can just call, and it's slightly less profitable than some other rivers for you, but it's not a bad river in that sense. And certainly if he checks, I think you can value bet any river. I think you're making too much of the scary river hand protection idea. And I think that if villain is really that big of a fish that he has trouble letting go of overpairs in any situation, just raise the flop.
I agree. So here's a question. Let's say you had 9-8, as in my hypothetical, mm-hmm. going into the turn. And the four comes down on the turn, putting the four to a straight on board. It doesn't make you a straight, but it puts the four to the straight on board. I would rather have that card than a redraw. Like, even though I had a lot of outs, and even though I didn't hit any outs to make my hand, like, I think it's such a good bluffing situation that I would just be fist pumping to have the four. I mean, would you agree with that?
I would. And a big part of the reason for that is that we know villain is capped. You know, yeah. We know that he can't possibly have a seven, so we don't have to worry about accidentally bluffing into a seven. Like, we're basically just guaranteed some profitable bluffs because we have tons of value hands that he doesn't have.
Yeah, so that's how good a bluff spot I think this is.
Yeah, and I do think I don't think I'd want to raise the flop with 9-8. I think I'd rather wait for a turn card like this one to do my bluffing. So I guess there is something a little bit exploitive to, I guess I announced that already, but yeah, I think there is something a little exploitive to raising the flop with a hand as strong as this one, when I don't think I would do a ton of bluff raising on the flop, just because I think against a lot of these kind of players that you describe, they are reluctant to fold over pairs. Over pairs are stronger on the flop than they are on later straights. So if you wait, you know, when you have a hand that you might want to bluff with, If you wait until a later street when the board gets scary and your opponent probably will let you know through some combination of his body language and his actions that he is scared, you have a better chance of taking the pot away from him then with kind of minimal risk. And when you actually have a value hand, you want to be front-loading that value and building the pot immediately before it gets scary and before he starts realizing that he should be folding over pairs.
Yeah. I also think that against me, so I'm not going to be calling too loose against this opponent who's marked himself with a good hand before the flop. As soon as the flop comes down like this, he should be checking a lot of hands to me, including some overpairs. So just because this board smacks my range pretty hard and he's not way ahead or way behind. So I'm going to have sets and pairs and straight draws and a couple two pairs and not a whole lot of like a seven suited and one pair hands that he can get lots of value from that aren't also drawing against him. So this is a board that favors me if I'm the caller, because I'm not calling too much before the flop. So I think he should check to that range. I mean, not that this person would, but just a side note.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say is Adam's final comment is, I'm not sure the result would have been any different if I had raised the turn to 120. And this is a kind of a common, mistake in thinking that I see a lot, where people, it's kind of a very results-oriented way of looking at things to say, well, your goal is not to avoid the exact thing that happened in this hand. Your goal is to kind of find the best way to play against his entire range, given all possible rivers and all possible runouts. So the idea of like, well, you know, I ended up getting stacked because I called the turn and called the river, so maybe raising the turn is the better play, but I don't know if it would have changed the outcome. I probably would have gotten stacked anyway. I mean, that might be true against the exact hand that your opponent had, but you know, we're not trying to find the best play given the exact hand your opponent had, because that's not information we had at the time you had to make the turn decision. So I think just generally the way to think about this is not would it have changed the result of this exact hand, but you know, just kind of thinking about, as we have done, you know, the entirety of the situation, all the hands your opponents might have, all the rivers that could come and all the river action that could happen, and trying to find the best hand given all of those, the best line given all of those possibilities, rather than just saying like, how could I have avoided the one unfortunate thing that happened to me in this exact hand?
Absolutely. So thank you, Adam, for writing in. I hope that the house renovations or whatever that noise is
neighbor's house renovation, sorry.
No, it's cool. It's a rare thing for people to actually be able to like do any kind of construction in San Francisco, so I'm glad. Yeah, it's so good for
construction
them.
Renovation is happening constantly because you can just make so much money renting these houses. A lot of people are converting houses into apartments or all sorts of... Yeah, new construction is difficult. Renovation is constant.
Understood. So I have nothing to say, and we probably should just be running the meetings right now anyway.
I like the idea of leaving that comment in there, actually. Our guest today is Asani Fisher, who I actually know primarily from some of his very early posts on the 2+2 forums, not necessarily poker strategy posts, just very entertaining troll sort of posts. And he's now mostly a daily fantasy sports player. I actually don't know a lot about what happened in the 10 years in between those posts that I enjoyed on 2+2 and his current career as a daily fantasy sports player. So hopefully that's something that we'll figure out today. Thanks for joining us, Asani.
Yeah, absolutely. Glad to be here.
Am I accurate, at least in what I've said so far?
Yeah, that everything from the trolling to the poker. Yeah, that was a very, very nice and accurate description, I would say.
I'm sure I'm not the only one either on the show or in the audience who has a lot of old school 2+2 nostalgia right now. Thanks for adding so much back in the day.
Yeah, absolutely. I still do get some people like see me in a poker room or something. Oh, you're the boiling oats guy or something. It's fun to be recognized as such.
Well, let's just start at the beginning. I mean, when did you start in with poker?
2003, 2004, the boom years. basically saw Rounders and saw Chris Moneymaker win the World Series like everyone else, and decided to give it a try.
Yeah, I see your reg date on 2 plus 2 is May 8th, 2004.
Yeah.
So you didn't really have a lot of experience with poker prior to that? You didn't grow up playing poker?
No, actually, my biological father was a professional poker player, but I never knew him that well. So I always knew about it, you know, that it was possible. And my family played home games, but nothing super serious. It wasn't until, you know, the internet came along with poker that I really got into it.
Wow. So he, or your biological father anyway, is a professional poker player, but you did not learn from him?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I've only met him like 5 times in my life before he passed. And we talked poker briefly, but no like in-depth strategy or anything like that.
Was that, I mean, were you already taking poker seriously, or had he passed away before that?
I never did. It was just during the start of my career when I thought I was really good because money was easy back then. Horrible. And so we never really dived into strategy talk much at all. No, never got a chance to.
What did you start out playing? I mean, did you dive right into it saying, like, I'm going to be a professional, or how did that transition happen?
Before my senior year of college, I worked a normal job and made like $5,000, you know, working all summer long. And I made a small deposit, I want to say on Paradise Poker, I think that was the name of the site, and just started playing single table tournament, sit and goes, and was able to run that up to like $10,000 in the first month. Of course, I lost that all back because I had no clue whatsoever about bankroll management, or I don't think anyone really knew what they were doing back then. But that it obviously had my interest based on that. You know, I saw how hard I had to work all summer long to make $5,000, and then just running it up in that short month had my intrigue for sure.
So you weren't like terrified that you lost $10,000? I feel like that would be more my reaction, more so than like, holy crap, I won $5,000. Is like, oh my God, I'm going to jump off a bridge. I just lost $10,000.
I don't get it. Everyone in my life has always been telling me to invest and take smart risks and everything. Yeah, I don't know. I don't fear going broke because I know the time when I have lost all my money, been backed into a corner, I can just go to the casino and just grind 1-3 for 16 hours a day and do that for a month. Like, I just don't fear being in that state. So because of that, I've always just had the balls to really go for it. I don't have a good logical argument. I would not advise people to do it my way. Let's be clear on that. But yeah, I don't know. I can remember having $4,000 and like in my accounts and probably only having like 1,000 offline and just two tabling 10-20 with 100 big blind stacks with that $4,000 and not caring if I lost it or not. This is like in 2004 when, you know, no one had explained to me that how ridiculous that is just yet.
So you must have moved pretty quickly then from single table sit and goes to 10-20 cash games.
Yeah, I had a big ego and just always thought I was like this. I remember I kept on the message board Football Guys, there was an Asani's poker thread thing. And someone mentioned someone on Poker Stars. Who was it? Nick Schulman. He was, I forget the name he played under, but someone just.
Was he the takeover?
Takeover. Yeah. That's correct. Someone wrote in my blog, the takeover is the best heads up sit and go. Whatever. And because they said that, I only had like $50,000 at the time. I just put like 25 of it on PokerStars and started playing him in 5K heads up sit and goes. Just because I was like, oh, someone said this guy's the best. That's not true. I'm the best. But and that didn't work out too well for me.
I guess you and Nick are probably friends though, huh?
No, he probably doesn't even remember me. I was just he probably thought I was some fish who came in for, you know, a few days and just lost some money to him.
Doesn't sound like he was wrong.
Yeah, good point.
It sounds like you have gone broke a couple of times over the course of your career.
Yeah, I made lots of mistakes throughout my poker career. Mostly it was just one of mistakes of ego. I can remember when like coaching first came out and I was just thinking, oh, I'm too good for that. I don't need coaching. And it wasn't until later in my poker career when I had a chance to, through my friend Aaron Jones, he was the initial introduction I had to a lot of the high stakes community. And I really was able to to befriend a lot of really good players and see, like, up close and personal all the right things they were doing and how far I was falling short. And that really changed my perspective, and I think I was able to take that into DFS, and now I'm, you know, hopefully a little more mature and responsible, and it's helped me a lot.
How did you meet Aaron?
On 2+2, probably in sporting events talking about basketball. We initially just talked a lot on there, and then probably, I want to say, met up for a game of pickup basketball at like 24-Hour Fitness in Vegas over the summer, probably, and just naturally became friends through that.
Do you remember any of the kind of aha moments that you got either through him or the people that he introduced you to? When you say, you know, I saw a lot of the things they were doing right, do you recall what any of those things were?
This might sound obvious, but that you actually need to have reasons for thinking you're better than everyone else. Like, my reason was really just like, I'm smarter than everyone else. They can't, you know, pick the right plays as much as me. When it's like, when I see the right players, they're like, oh no, they can quantify the exact mistakes their opponents are making and how they don't do that and be like, this person's making a 0.3 big blind mistake by doing this with this hand in this spot. And there's actual concrete evidence, not just your ego letting you believe that you're the best because you want to think that, you know? That was a major aha moment. Other than that, just a lot of really seeing the hard work up close and personal. You know, I always told myself I was a hard worker, but I was a hard worker in that I would read the poker books, but I wouldn't, like, truly study them and break down the game theory and do all the things that are really necessary. I can remember going to Mike McDonald, Timex. We went up to Waterloo for one of his birthdays like a few years back. And the first thing he said when we got there, this was one of the first times I was really getting to know him, he was just like, so I've been working on this, this, and this with poker and this. And he had all these cool ideas he wanted to talk to our group of friends about. And I was like, that was a major breakthrough to me, just to see the enthusiasm and the willingness to really do work off the tables on your poker game, you know?
Yeah, that's the right person to be learning from.
Yeah, for sure.
Did you have justification for, I mean, I know it doesn't sound like your poker results necessarily justified the size of the ego. I mean, outside of poker, were you someone who kind of like breezed through school? Did stuff generally come to you easily, or was this ego really just kind of unfounded across the board?
I guess it came, I was kind of an underachiever, I guess. Like, I found out from a young age, you know, my parents wanted a B average, so I just maintained a B average and didn't, you know, do anything above and beyond. It was probably really bad for me that poker came along right after college, because, like, I didn't deserve to just have a bunch of money handed to me in that regard, you know? I don't know. I was a young, typical young male who, yeah, just had a lot of ego about a lot of things, I guess.
Are you also making extravagant purchases? The points where you went broke, was it entirely due to poor bankroll management, or was it also like spending a lot of money outside of poker on, you know, fancy cars, that sort of thing?
I spent a lot of money on drinking and partying. You know, I lived outside New York City and then outside Vegas. So yeah, when especially, you know, if you're going, you know, to a local Vegas room to play poker and then going to the club afterwards, once you've had a winning session, it's easy to be a little excessive. And yeah, like I had a stupid platinum and diamond necklace that was like $1,500 that I would never in a million years wear today. But so yes, to answer your question, I had many life leaks in this regard, and yeah, they all came together to make me go broke like two or three times.
I didn't really have any idea what you looked like until I saw your video log, but you don't seem like a platinum and diamond necklace sort of guy.
I'm not. It was not a good look.
I wonder, I mean, this show actually has a, we call ourselves the Nitcast sometimes because we talk a lot about not so much being nitty in poker, but being, you know, keeping life expenses down and that sort of thing. So, you definitely don't have to explain to me the foolishness of spending money at clubs, but I wonder if any of that, if you look back at it, is in some sense a wise investment. Like, it was part of what enabled you to become friends with people who are really good at poker, and like partying with them, maybe you can look at it as like an investment in networking.
Yeah, maybe. Well, and also just all these mistakes that I'm talking about here, they were an investment in overcoming those leaks, and especially in poker, is what's helped me become so good at DFS and being like aware to not make the same mistakes again. So maybe, I mean, like, yes, probably in a networking sense, but I would also say just in a sense of you need to mess up when you're in your young 20s. You're supposed to be making lots of mistakes and, you know, being, then you reflect on it and get better. And so, yeah, I look at all those mistakes as somewhat of an investment just then, and they paid off ultimately because I was able to be somewhat self-aware about them and work hard to overcome them.
So you really just look at it as, you know, whatever mistakes I made were all just kind of necessary for me to get to where I am now in my life. Not, it doesn't sound like you have a lot of regret attached to what I mean, I imagine you took some pretty big losses at points.
Yeah. I wouldn't say they're necessary, like, for every, like, I certainly wouldn't advise this, like I said, but for me, I guess necessary, man, that's a weird, I don't know if they are or not. It's just kind of the way it worked out, you know? Yeah, I don't really know how to answer that.
Yeah, I think I feel some sympathy with Asani here. Like, I think there was a lot of stuff I did that, in hindsight, feels like a cheap way to not be a dumbass anymore. Like, but you're in DFS now, and you think that poker was, like, how continuous is DFS with poker?
Sorry, what do you mean? Like, do I play both still, or
how much do the skills that you learned at poker transfer to DFS?
So much. Pretty much everything we've talked about, like, so far, just bankroll management, understanding that you have to quantify your edges and actually see where they come from, and working hard. And the times where, you know, where I was talking about how Aaron introduced me to a lot of the high stakes poker community, I feel as if I've been able to view them up close and personal and see all the strengths that each of them have as individuals that make them such great poker players, and initially I was trying to apply those to my poker playing, and now I've done so with DFS and apply them to my DFS playing.
Makes sense. So how much is there so it seems to me that a big part of success at poker is making the right decision in the moment, and whether that's sort of the guts to make the, you know, big bluff, or just remembering the right strategy at a particular moment, that's very important. That seems to be a smaller part of DFS. Is that right? Or are there really sort of high variance plays that it's hard to pull the trigger on, but it's important to pull the trigger on?
Yeah. You use the phrase in the moment. I would say that only exists in DFS with super late breaking news. And this happens more in basketball DFS than other sports, where 3 minutes before the lineups lock, you'll find out one player's injured, his backup's starting, and you got to decide if it's worth it to play him or not and make these super important decisions that are affecting your EV in only, you know, a few minutes. Most of the time in DFS, you'll have a whole afternoon to think it over. So that's one distinction, I guess, I would draw between the two.
Makes sense. And we're recording this on October 16th, the day after the big licensing news dropped. You live in Nevada, yes?
Yes, correct.
And is this messing up your life?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, so I guess for listeners who don't know, please correct me if I'm wrong, but the Nevada legislature ruled that you cannot offer DFS in Nevada without a license. Is that right?
Yeah, that sounds correct to me. And beyond like how easy it's going to be to obtain a license or stuff like that, we're still basically waiting to hear more.
Yeah. And what's your contingency plan if everybody moves out of Nevada and you can't get on DraftKings or FanDuel legally there?
Yeah. I have to be playing DFS right now. The time and money is good right now. I'll move or do whatever I have to do just to keep playing. It's frustrating, and yeah, at this point in time, I'm just sitting back and waiting for more info to come out. But I absolutely intend to keep playing and do whatever it takes to keep playing.
All right. And is that, do you think that's what most people over there are doing?
It depends for each person's situation. I assume a lot of DFS pros who live in Nevada also have experience in poker. And so I do think, you know, probably a lot of the mid-stakes DFS grinders that can't afford to just, you know, rent out another place in another state will turn to poker momentarily. I would think most of the high-end players would be willing to move.
In all frankness, not that I would condone this, but I imagine some of them will just set up VPNs. I mean, people do that in poker, and I think PokerStars is working a lot harder to catch some of these people than DraftKings might. So you think that people just keep on playing, you know, however they manage to do it?
Yeah, I would think so. I've never used a VPN even in poker. I moved to Toronto to play, and then La Paz, Mexico.
Good for you.
yeah. But yeah, I assume that's a natural offshoot. It sucks that people who aren't intending to do anything wrong, they just want to play DFS, are forced to look into these, you know, gray areas. It just sucks. The whole situation kind of sucks for everyone.
I don't really know enough about DFS to answer, so this might end up being an obvious question, but is there, I feel like a lot of the problem with using the VPN on, say, PokerStars is that the people who are getting hurt are other players who kind of deserve to have reads on you. Like, you have reads on them, and because you're playing under a different name on a VPN, they don't have access to that same like reciprocal information. Is that an issue in DFS? Like, if you were to just set up a VPN, would you be hurting other players in that way?
I'm not even sure, because it sounds like what the problem in poker you just described is when you have an account that people don't even know that's you.
Right.
I was assuming it would just be a VPN under your same screen name that we were talking about previously. But yeah, obviously although that's not as big of a problem in poker, it's not as big a problem in DFS to not recognize your opponent's screen name. It's still an advantage that you just can't have. You know, we can't allow people to have any little advantage like that, because other people will complain about it, you know, and edges are important. So yeah, you should have full disclosure about who you're playing. I do think that would be very unfair if DFS opponents didn't realize they were playing me or something like that.
So you would actually adapt your strategy depending on who you're playing against?
No, well, for game selection purposes.
I see.
I probably wouldn't. I would not change my lineup, though, based on who I'm playing against. No, so in that regard, it is much different than poker in that regard.
So if you haven't already, I think you'll soon realize that I know virtually nothing about sports or DFS. So apologies in advance if I ask something that ends up being a completely stupid question, but probably some people in our audience will be in the same boat.
No worries. No, all the questions have been great so far.
So I've dabbled in DFS just a little bit, and I'm curious, for somebody who's like a working pro at it, how much of your edge is algorithmic? So you compared to me, I have my algorithms that I would use. So I would input some statistics into an algorithm, and the statistics would be sort of predictions for what a player is going to do on a given day. And then it would output lineups. And there are two ways that you could have an edge on me in this kind of, if you factor out the process like that. You could have better data. You could feed in better data than me, or you could have a better algorithm than me. I imagine you have edges on me in both aspects, but which one's more important?
Well, so I just use publicly available data. There's nothing, I'm trying to think to make sure on this. Yeah, there's nothing I use that isn't publicly available right now. So my edges are not coming from, you know, having my own private, you know, projections that no one else gets to see. I pretty much just, I learned about DFS by Googling and reading every single thing I could, and then trying to discern between which sites knew what they were talking about and should be trusted and which sites shouldn't. I can imagine that in the future, as the evolution of DFS occurs, that the real top end elite players will have just super accurate projections or models that they have built on their own. I don't know if we're that far into DFS's evolution that we've really reached that point yet. Maybe a few of the top guys do, but certainly not all of them right now, and I do not.
So if I finish my dissertation real fast and then spend all that time in DFS, is there still room for somebody to, am I too late to the party? Like, could I catch up if I got into it now?
I think so. I think, I mean, it would have been better if you got in 2-3 years ago. I only got in a year ago at the beginning of football season last year in 2014. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think we're still – I recently in one of my video blogs I referred to it as the golden age that we're still in. Not nearly as good as the poker boom, but like I don't know. It's like 2008, 2009 poker right now to give a comparison.
So plenty good enough.
Yeah, exactly.
What was the impetus for you to get into DFS in the first place?
I've always been a huge sports fan, particularly basketball. My friend Aaron Jones tried to convince me for a while. He was playing it pretty casually and wanted me to jump in, and I never did. And it was actually a conversation with Scott Seaver. He was talking about the millionaire maker in football, and it just sounded really cool to me that you could win $1 million in a football contest. And yeah, he convinced me to put, I think, like $600 on and, you know, get with the deposit bonus and give it a try.
Had you played, I mean, not daily fantasy sports, but just, you know, in like a fantasy league, that kind of thing, I assume you'd done before?
Yeah, I absolutely had. I'd done it for, I don't know, maybe like 6-7 years. But like a lot of people, I was kind of getting tired of some of the drawbacks of it, namely that, you know, if you start off doing bad early in the year, you're kind of out of it for the rest of the year, and only the people who are in contention end up really caring about it. And yeah, so when I saw, I right away I understood like why DFS was something so cool. I'm like, oh, it has a lot of advantages that that the normal fantasy sports don't have.
Where was your poker career at that point?
Not great. I had in like 2012 or 2000, yeah, about 2012, I was doing all right with poker. I had done well with some heads up PLO8, and from 2012 to 2014, I really struggled. I was playing live 2-5 no limit, to give a better frame of reference.
Was that a function of low bankroll or feeling like you were struggling to compete in the bigger games?
Low bankroll mostly. I would have definitely played 5-10 or 10-20 if I was bankrolled for it.
Okay, so you're struggling. This is like shortly after, or I know you said you moved to Toronto after Black Friday, right?
Sometime in 2012 I went there. Not right away. No, I took a few years off after Black Friday, I guess, and just played live.
Mm-hmm. In Las Vegas?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
How were the games that, like, immediately after Black Friday? I imagine there were a lot of people who did the same thing you did. Just like, well, if I can't play online, I guess I'm going to the Bellagio.
Yeah, yeah. It was a real, you know, before Black Friday, live games were always just insanely soft because, yeah, like you say, there was internet games and there were live games. And when after Black Friday, they got mixed a lot, you know, the player pools. And yeah, it was, I first really noticed the big improvements when I went back to online poker like a year or two after Black Friday had happened. Like I said, PLO8 was my main game, and before Black Friday, I felt like if I wasn't the best, I was, you know, top two or three at that. And then everyone improved quickly after Black Friday. Best way to explain it. And I fairly quickly got passed by, and that's probably why, you know, a lot of my struggles were I just jumped back in and thought I was gonna, you know, be able to play in the same games I had been playing in previously, and I was really in for a rude awakening.
Yeah, I guess you don't get much opportunity to practice PLO8 playing live in Las Vegas.
Yeah, not at all.
What goes? I mean, I assume there's other things you can do to practice though besides just playing, or has that always been your main way of learning?
I think when I was younger, I just went and played. I read books too, I guess I would say, but if doing things optimally, I think work away from the tables is very important. Just working with everything you can get your hands on, understanding, you know, the game trees and all the game theory aspects as intricately as you possibly can is very important. And just probably most important is just discussion with friends, you know, taking people who are at or close to your level, or maybe, you know, it's slightly better, and just having, you know, 2-3 hour conversations about concepts and different spots and really diving into it is the best way for improvement that I can think of.
How much does that kind of stuff factor into DFS? Is game theory even a thing that people talk about there?
Yeah, there are different spots where, like, you might need to make a swap on DraftKings. So you might be in third place, or let's say like 10th place in a tournament going into the Monday night football game, and one of the guys ahead of you shares the same player you have, so you might want to, so you have no means of passing him. So your only way to get the super high first prize is to change to a guy who has lower EV, which is going to hurt your equity against the rest of your field, the field, but give you the only chance you have at first place. And so there's like spots like that where, wow, I don't know what to do. How's the EV of each, you know, decision balance here? And in spots like that, I find it really helpful to just tell my friends the situation and then we talk about it. Because it's really hard, you know, on your own to come to exact conclusions about stuff like that.
Is that also the sort of thing where the player who's currently in first place might consider, you know, try to guess whether you're going to do that and also trade away that player?
So yes, that has not happened. So the best of my knowledge, no one has been able to do it yet. But yeah, that would be so badass when that eventually does happen. It's definitely like people, it's one of those things where people always talk about it, but you just don't want to, like, the worst thing is if you reverse level yourself. If you're ahead and you switch to the lower EV player and the other guy for whatever reason doesn't, and then, you know, you end up losing. So like, I don't know if anyone's really had the balls to do it yet. You would have to really know that the guy below, the guy who's trailing you is, you know, a top level thinker who you can guarantee will make the switch. And so, yeah, that moment, to the best of my knowledge, has not yet occurred, but it eventually will. And when it does, it'll be awesome.
is there other stuff that you think I would find interesting as someone who doesn't know anything? So like, I found that really fascinating, what you just said. Are there other little like tidbits like that that you would tell or that you do tell, you know, your family or whatever, people who don't know anything about DFS? Like, what do you think people who don't know anything about it would find interesting?
Find interesting.
I mean, people who do have an interest in like game strategy, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, you know, in terms of just looking at the lobby, it's very similar to poker. You know, like understanding the lobby, knowing how to game select, knowing how to get in the right games. Like the heads up lobby, like in poker, for example, it's, you know, you want to be the one sitting by yourself to get the fish, and so there's a battle for the lobby. Those aspects come into play as well. Yeah, I don't have anything else off the top of my head in that regard, though.
So what happened last week with the – I mean, I have the layperson's understanding of, like, it's like insider trading, the whole business about the guy using information who worked for the one site to place bets on the other site. I watched your video log on it, and I'm still not really sure I understood what your take on the situation was, if you wouldn't mind giving it again.
Sure. So my take is that there was a huge coincidence that – when the DraftKings employee who was playing on FanDuel, and there were many on both sides playing on the other site, he happened to win a big tournament the same week he happened to leak information too early, the ownership percentages on DraftKings, and everyone was like up in arms about, well, why do you even have this information? This is obviously cheating. So the coincidence of the matter made it such that it seemed like this could be a clear case of cheating. As we've looked into it, everything I've heard makes it seem like there was no foul play. And so the coincidence is kind of a good thing in that it made us all question everything a bunch harder. Obviously, we should, you know, keep looking into it as best as we can. But yeah, as far as I know, Ethan did nothing wrong. He won his money legitimately. And the phrase insider trading is just a real – it has such a negative connotation that people instantly want to think something's, you know, there's foul play. I think it is a good decision that both sites have no longer allow their employees to play on other sites. And yeah, that's about it, I guess.
How much does it worry you that employees have access to, you know, sharp lineups, et cetera?
Yeah. It's definitely something that needs to be monitored. You know, it's something that, no, like I said, before this, none of us really thought about it much. This was not a topic of conversation. Now that, you know, it's been brought to our attention and we start to think of the what ifs, like, you know, it's not. So in this particular case, he had access to overall ownership percentages, which I think are not actually that important whatsoever. I think it's more important to look at the DraftKings Thursday contest if you want to predict the FanDuel Thursday contest if you want to predict the FanDuel Sunday contest than looking at the DraftKings Sunday. So I don't think it was even that important. But if he had access to like just the top five players lineups, then he could, you know, make plus EV lineups just using that consensus. So it's really important that we have third party checks and that the both sites are very transparent with who has access to the information and when the, every time they look at it, there needs to be some sort of log created or record of that.
Is there any kind of comparison to being able to see someone's whole cards in poker? Like if an employee has access to your lineup, is there some way that he could share that information with one of your opponents to your detriment?
There's a very slight comparison, but it's not near. If someone saw my whole cards in poker, they would be guaranteed to play me or guaranteed to beat me. If someone knew the players I was playing in DFS, I thought they were a fish still, I would still play them 100%. So, you know what I mean?
That's a pretty big difference.
If I knew like a top end player had this slight little edge, then it would be like, oh, well, then, you know, it would worry me. But like, I just think it's not really comparable.
Yeah, the kind of takeaway that I had from I haven't really made much of an effort to follow it other than watching your video about it. But yeah, the takeaway that I had was more, even if this player didn't do anything wrong, it did seem like there wasn't much in the way of I'm hesitant to use the word regulation because I don't know if it's necessarily something that has to come from the outside, but it just didn't necessarily seem like these sites really had any kind of policy in place to prevent something from happening, or even that a lot of people hadn't really thought about what could happen.
Yeah, it's a weird thing because you want people that work for the sites to be fans of the game themselves. You know, the best poker dealers I know are people who in their spare time go play at other poker rooms. You know, it's good to have people passionate about the industry, and you want former players to be working for the company so they understand what the user experience is like and what the user needs. So I think initially when I saw that, I knew before this that DraftKings employees were playing on FanDuel and vice versa, and I always just thought it was fine, no big deal. Yeah, so it's one of those things that, yeah, now that it's brought up, it's like, oh, yeah, right, this is an issue. I can see how this could lead to complications or cheating scandals or such, and we have to have better policies in place. But it's hard for me to criticize the sites when I didn't even think of it myself. And it seems like it's...
But shouldn't it be their job to think of it? I mean, if they're the ones running the game, shouldn't they be anticipating and kind of maintaining the security of those games?
Yes, ideally they should, but I mean, if you look at most of the poker scandals, isn't it a lot of the users that figure them out rather than the sites?
Yeah, but I've always held that against the sites.
Fair enough. No, that's a totally fair criticism, but I think you're asking a lot of the companies who are, you know, have tons of other people have lots of complaints about the, you know, poker sites, DFS sites, and everything. Whether it's, oh, the software isn't very good, I want them to improve that, or the customer service isn't good, or this and that, and all of it requires money. And so by the sites, and both DFS sites have lost money so far in their business lives. So it's, you can't just expect them to have spent, you know, a whole nother $100,000 on a fraud department to look after every little thing. I do think now that we know it's an issue, we can demand that, hey, this is an important issue. You do need to take care of it now. But I don't really hold it against them that they weren't on top of the issue from the beginning. But I will very strongly judge them based upon how they respond now that everyone's aware that this is an issue for sure.
Boy, the gambling world is a funny place. Just to offer like a different perspective, those of us who like work in non-gambling companies, like this idea that security is like this afterthought and like money is scarce and like, you know, how can you really expect them to like care at all about security when there are things like flashing lights to worry about? You know, like a unique perspective, right?
yeah. I just every professional, like the fact that I didn't think of it myself, like makes me, like I said, that just makes me be much more forgiving towards them about it, because I feel like, as a gambler, you know, I should be aware of like if I could be being cheated. You know, that's something I have my eyes out for constantly. And so the fact that neither me nor any of my friends who, you know, talk about stuff like this on the regular, this never even came across our minds. therefore it's somewhat hard for me to judge them. But I can understand that outside perspective. You know, no, it is their job to be doing this, so maybe they should have been.
Yeah, I mean, when it doesn't come across your mind, the only person who suffers from that, like, you only cost yourself money when something goes wrong. When it doesn't come across their mind, it would seem to me that they're kind of failing in an obligation to their customers. I think there's at least an implicit expectation that they're going to be running a fair game. And if it turns out that they haven't I guess the question is what's reasonable, but it seems like they haven't put a lot of thought into making sure that game is fair. If I were a customer, I would, and I did on you know, when stuff happened in poker, feel slighted by that.
Yeah, I guess it's hard. Like, I feel very uninformed on what it's like to try to run a DFS site or a poker site. And because of that, I'm hesitant to criticize, but I don't disagree with any of your general sentiments. You know, like I find myself nodding my head in agreement as you're saying all this, but then I really have no experience whatsoever of what, like, the day to day of a person, you know, working at one of these sites is like. So it's hard for me to truly say they definitely should have done this and this and this. That's all.
Do you expect to see kind of like a brain drain now from those sites if there were people who are kind of making money working for the sites and also betting on the other site, if they're forced to choose between the two? Do you think a lot of people are going to be quitting their jobs at, say, DraftKings in order to be able to play on DraftKings and on FanDuel?
I don't think you'll see much of that at all. I don't think there were that many people making enough money from playing that they could quit their jobs. I think the who's the one? There's the guy who sets the FanDuel pricing is a very good DFS player. And he's the one – I'm sorry. I don't remember his name off the top of my head. He's the one guy who I could see quitting because he has more potential playing. But really, he's like literally the only person I can think of off the top of my head that would be optimal for. I think most of them are not – I don't think they're making – like they're not all like huge winners. There's plenty of them are losing players, you know?
And those of us in poker should be plenty familiar with the phenomenon of people who work in poker being losing poker players. That's a well attested phenomenon.
Yes, sir.
Those of us who are old enough remember that, like, calling somebody a poker dealer, like, it was just sort of understood that a lot of poker dealers were people who busted out as pros, and, like, you know, there wasn't any shame in it. It was just a fact of life. I mean, that all changed in the early 2000s, I guess, but. It used to be it's like you won't believe this, but there are people who work in gambling who are losing gamblers. Like well, okay.
How are you liking the life of a DFS grinder compared to the life of a poker grinder, both pre and post Black Friday?
Yeah, it's I like it a lot better. It's different in that when you play poker, you're constantly making decisions, you know, your whole day. Whereas DFS all leads up until lineups lock. You're not like in poker, you're sweating the results as you're making the decisions. So it's very important to be able to, when you lose a big pot, to be able to move on to the next hand. In DFS, you make all your decisions and then you just sit down in front of the TV and sweat it for a few hours, which really allows you to enjoy the emotions of sweating a lot more, because if you want to just, you know, go on a temper tantrum, you can, because you don't need to make any more decisions, so just have loose and then make sure you're okay by the next day and your mindset's better by the next day, but, you know, just have at it. So it's kind of more fun in that regard. You can just go crazy and sweat your guys.
If you had the opportunity to I guess we don't want to go all the way back to, like, how profitable games were in 2004, but, you know, if you could make sort of the same amount of money playing online poker as you could playing DFS, it sounds like you would choose DFS?
Probably. I mean, like, so in 2003, 2004, it was also just the poker lifestyle. It became such a cultural thing where it was, like, it was cool and fun. It was fun to go, you know, to one of the big Vegas poker rooms on a Friday night and play poker. There were, you know, it wasn't just 40-year-old men with headphones on. It was actually a social environment where it was a fun thing to do. I enjoyed it then, but then as online poker games got tougher and it was just, you know, sitting in front of your computer for 12 hours a day, I would definitely take DFS over what poker turned into.
Do you play poker at all now?
I played the World Series this summer. I went in with a legitimate mindset of I'm a DFS pro now. I don't need to make money at this. Let's just enjoy it. And I really tried my best to enjoy it. And if I'm honest, I just didn't. the main event, which you think, I mean, like, the main event's great. Don't get me wrong. You know, it's they do a good job with it. There's, you know, so many amateur players and everyone's there to have a lot of people there to have fun. So you get fun tables a lot. But man, it's just the grind of sitting in a chair for 12, you know, getting to the there at noon and then, it's just too much. And yeah, I'll play cash games. I enjoy occasionally, you know, on a Friday night, just going playing for like 3-4 hours. But the idea of playing poker for 12 plus hours a day just isn't that enticing to me anymore.
Do you compare DFS now to kind of poker in 2008? How quickly is it maturing? I mean, my guess would be that, especially because you have so many kind of experienced poker players who are moving into DFS, I would think that people would be getting a lot better a lot faster than what was happening in, you know, over the course of poker's evolution.
Yeah, absolutely. People's general gambling sense is simply much more evolved than it was, you know, 10, 15 years ago. If I had to make a guess, I would say, assuming, you know, legislation and stuff like this isn't, you know, an ongoing issue, I would say we have like 3 guaranteed years of, you know, it being still really good. And then, you know, after 3 to 5 years, I would assume it's going to, you know, get to a place where poker got, you know, in like 3 to 5 years. So definitely much quicker, like you said.
Do you have a contingency plan?
I would not necessarily.
So
I
mean, no.
I mean, my true passion is working in basketball, and I would love to somehow parlay this into, you know, an NBA job or something like that. But that's not necessarily something I'm planning on, you know, that you can assure yourself of having. But, you know, I've been able to make a decent amount of money this past year at least, so I can, you know, look in other investments and stuff like that. But, yeah, I guess no is the short answer to that.
I'm just wondering, I mean, it sounds like you're probably about, if not exactly, the same age that I am, and I don't know, probably the window is starting to close on non-gambling career opportunities.
Yeah, I'm 33. And
yeah, right about the same age.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons that I have been trying to, you know, do my video blog more and just like try out different avenues, not just, you know, making money strictly from playing DFS. And I've really enjoyed that, you know, the media aspects, and maybe could do that a little bit more. But yeah, it's, you know, just an ongoing. I have basically been too focused on DFS is good. Now's the time. Let's just focus on that and then evaluate afterwards, which maybe I should plan ahead a little more now that I think about it. But yeah, I don't have a great plan in place, I guess, if it falls through suddenly.
What do the edges look like in DFS? My understanding is that it's quite top heavy in terms of, you know, where a lot of the money is going, how many people are winning.
In terms of overall winners and versus losers, I'm not sure where that is. I can tell you, I'm looking here. I've just brought up my statistics. I have a 12.66% ROI over everything.
Jeez.
I don't know how that. I mean,
it sounds pretty big to me.
Does it? Okay. I mean, I don't know how that compares to like a poker tournament player or, you know, anything like that. But yeah. Edges are when you're early in a sport or not a sport but DFS's evolution, the edges that to be had are bigger. You know, obviously the top end players versus the players who are, you know, that's why everyone says if they could go back to 2013 they'd be great at poker, because it, you know, they make so much because the edges to be had are so big then. But you know, it's slowly diminishing, and just, you know, there's more and more training sites and stuff coming out that people are indeed getting better. Those edges are getting smaller.
Well, you know, my original interest in you, as I mentioned, your name had kind of slipped off my radar for a while, but you know, I really enjoyed these early 2+2 posts that you made. I'm kind of hesitant even to try to describe them, but just to and I'll put links in the show notes for people. But for people who haven't seen these, there's one where you post as though it were a game that everyone would be familiar with. You just post this long in-depth strategy discussion of what seems to be just a game that you made up, and then ask for people's feedback on it, and just play the whole thing straight throughout the thread. And I guess a few other people chimed in and pretended that they knew what you were talking about. And then the other even more bizarre one, you claimed to have gotten this job offer. What was the deal? You're going to get $1 million after 20 years, but you have to carry a bucket of boiling oats every morning.
Correct. Yes.
And so again, you're kind of presenting this as though it's something that people might be familiar with, and asking for their advice and whether you should accept this job. What was your desire to? You clearly put a lot of work into these posts.
I have a very bizarre sense of humor, but I think I'm good at that bizarre sense of humor. I guess the general gist of it was to make some sort of ridiculous claim, but then maintain that I'm not saying anything ridiculous, and that, you know, I'm playing it straight, and that this is, I'm telling it's, you know, all the facts, and I'm not lying at all, because I would anticipate certain uppity people on message boards, you know, not being like getting upset by it, basically, and just trying to play off how I knew they would react. I guess is the best way I could say. And I just liked confusing people and being weird in general when I was younger.
Yeah, it does seem like you provoked a fair amount of hate.
Yeah, I was very – the younger Asani on 2+2 was hate him or love him, very much so. I think I've gotten a bit more tame in my older age, but yeah.
Do you have heroes in comedy?
In comedy?
Yeah. Are there people you really sort of love and admire?
I do, but no one that I've gotten that style from. I would just say like stand-ups like Louis C.K., you know, I enjoy a lot. But
You're not like an Andy Kaufman.
No, never got into it.
All right.
Anything we've left off, Asani? Interesting stuff that interesting stuff in your life that I just didn't know enough to ask you about?
Let me think. Nothing like in particular that I can really think of. I think we covered a lot of my gambling career and everything, you know. All my focus was, you know, so much on all these recent happenings today, so that's kind of taking my mindset off things. But sure. Yeah, nothing I can really think of.
Well good luck with adapting to that. I'm sure it's a stressful time for you right now, but it sounds like you have at least a bit of a cushion that you're not wondering where your rent money's going to come from.
Yeah. Good thing I do have some money saved up, and yeah, I can sit back and, you know, make the best decision in a few days once more information comes out.
And moving to another state certainly is less complicated than moving to another country.
Yeah, for sure. So there's that advantage over poker, at least.
Well, thanks again for talking to us. I'm glad I finally got a chance to meet you. I really did enjoy those early 2+2 posts.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed it. I'd be glad to do it again.
Fantastic. Thanks so much.
All right. Cool. Take care. You